Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today will open the University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture Series tomorrow evening at the Reynolds Center. Writer Charles Mann has covered the intersection of science, technology, and commerce in his writings for the New York Times, the Washington Post, Vanity Fair, National Geographic, and the Atlantic Monthly, among others. While currently he's been writing about the new hydrocarbon revolution in energy production and technology, he's best known for his social science histories of the Americas on the eve of and immediate aftermath of European discovery. 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, describes a very different new world from our old history books, with great cities, some societies with advanced technologies for the time, and a highly advanced agriculture generally compared to Europe or Asia. That book won the U.S. National Academy of Sciences Keck Award for Best Book of the Year. His following book, 1493, Uncovering the World Columbus Created, describes one of the first instances of what we now know as globalization, as products, technology, and wealth, as well as social ills, disease, and human trafficking, transferred between continents in what we call today the Columbian Exchange. Charles Mann kicks off the University of Tulsa's Presidential Lecture Series tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center. The lecture is free to the public, and he joins us by phone today on Studio Tulsa. Charles Mann, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Your most recent published work, in book form, has looked at the world as Europeans found it around Columbus's European discovery of the New World, and debunking a lot of the ideas, ingrained history that surrounds Columbus's discovery, if you will. Could you describe the life and cultures that existed in the Western Hemisphere in 1491?
Well, sometimes I imagine what would be like if we were flying over somehow the Americas just before Columbus's arrival. And say you were in a plane and you were looking down and you started where I live, which is in the New England, and you look down, what you would have seen is all these village alliances, lots and lots of cornfields everywhere you went, and then you would go fly over and go over the Mississippi, and you'd see thousands of what they call mound villages, and mound cities, which are settlements of ranging from a few hundred to many thousands, focused around big ceremonial pyramids, mounds made of earthen construction, really quite elaborate. The biggest one of which was in near St. Louis in Cahokia, and if you go further south than that, you would have seen what's called the Aztec Empire, which is sort of a made-up name that came in the 19th century. It's an alliance of three states based in this incredible Venice-like city in the middle of a lake. It's a huge, huge lake in central Mexico, and there is this alliance there, and they're fighting it out with another empire called the Tarascans. You've seen a bunch of Mayan states. Then you would have gone further south, and you would have looked at the Andes, and you would have seen the world's largest empire at that time. That was the Inca Empire, which stretched over a distance equivalent from Stockholm to Cairo, the world's largest highway network, really kind of an impressive place, run by a horribly totalitarian government. And then you would have flown over to the Amazon, and you would have seen all these networks of interlinked mid-sized cities, really quite an extraordinary place. So what Columbus landed on, though he didn't know it, was really a bustling, thriving place full of millions and millions of people doing interesting things.
Although he landed on a few outlier islands.
Right, he landed on the periphery.
Yeah.
And, it would have been like, if you could imagine somebody from the Americas going to Europe and landing in some place like Lapland, where they had nomadic guys running around with reindeer or something. I don't actually know that much about Lapland, but you get the idea.
And what we now know as Mexico City, which was home of the Aztec Empire, you write that it had running water hundreds of years before it would be found in London or Paris or Berlin or any of the European capitals. How advanced was it compared to those European cities from whence the explorers came?
It was actually quite an engineering feat. This is where Mexico City now is. Mexico City is more or less on top of the old capital of Tenochtitlan. And it's in a basin, surrounded by mountains, and all this water funnels off the mountains and in this basin. And so there's this big brackish lake there. And this was completely artificially recontoured and dredged and fixed up and filled with baffles and all kinds of engineering feats to create this lake. And then a bunch of small islands on the western side were then reshaped and turned into something very much like Venice. It's built up very much like Venice. The big difference between Tenochtitlan and Venice is that Venice's population never got above 90 or 100,000. And Tenochtitlan, the latest estimate I've seen, was close to 225,000. So it was bigger. So it was this island city that was bigger than any city in Spain, for example. Madrid just had a population of about 40,000 then. So when the conquistadors, you know, Cortez and his guys, came over the mountains and looked down at this thing, they were looking at something that was more magnificent than any city that they had ever seen. It had aqueducts that channeled in fresh water to the place. It had this incredible sewage collection system, and it had botanical gardens, none of which existed in Europe at the time. It was really quite a thriving, remarkable imperial capital.
And yet, there must have been something when Cortez saw this, either greed or the way Aztecs situated their society, that it convinced him he needed to attack rather than try to learn.
Well, that was kind of the way people thought back then. I mean, it's not, you know, the Aztecs had sort of a similar idea when they saw neighboring groups, the Tarascans or the Maya or the Mixtecs or, you know, whoever they were. Their idea wasn't, oh, let's learn from them. Their idea was basically, let's attack them. And one of the striking things is that they're a literate society. There was tons of stuff written by them. And as far as I'm aware, in all the voluminous description by the in Nahua, which is the language they spoke, of the conquest, there's never once any kind of thing saying, why are they doing this? We wouldn't have done it to them. I think this sort of imperial impulse to, you know, just conquer something, they understood full well.
And of course, the story of keeping on Cortez, the stories that, you know, you always learn in the history books is that Cortez originally was rebuffed, but eventually the Aztecs basically surrendered. And
that's wrong.
I know, it's absolutely wrong. But in fact, you know, Cortez had a handful of men to conquer this huge empire. But
that's,
of course,
that's sort of wrong too.
Okay.
The Aztecs were these imperial rulers, right? And kind of like conquerors everywhere, they weren't exactly liked by the people they had conquered. I mean, that's sort of a standard thing. They conquer you and you resent it. So he was able to, he was really a master politician. He was able to hijack that resentment and unify the opposition. So he and his, you know, few hundred Spaniards marched at the head of an enormous native army. And Ross Hassig, who is probably the leading military historian of that period, I think estimates that he had something like 200,000 troops.
Wow.
What you saw was an enormous battle. Just a huge battle. And just as you say, they lost the first one. And then, you know, with tremendous loss of life, two-thirds of Spaniards were killed and all the horses were killed. And it was called the Noche Triste. And supposedly, you know, after Cortez was driven out of Tenochtitlan, he sat under a tree and cried, you know, at the ruin of his hopes. But this guy was, you know, the Aztecs made this huge mistake in not killing him, you know, chasing him down and just slaughtering him. He was amazingly determined, you know, fanatically determined, and he then unified the troops. And he was enormously helped by a coincidence at that time, which is that smallpox arrived. Smallpox didn't exist in the Americas, and just at that time, by coincidence, it's generally traced to an infected slave named Bagia or Eguia. He came and he infected the continent, and you know, of course, it's something that native people had never seen. It's a brand new disease to the Americas. And in the space of a few months, it killed something like 30% of the people in, you know, central Mexico, something like that. Nobody really knows. I mean, it's an unfathomable disaster. And it killed the new emperor, killed a whole lot of the courts, it killed a whole lot of the generals. And all the Spaniards who had had smallpox as children, with a childhood disease for people in Europe, survived. You know, they didn't get affected at all. And they were able to essentially to use their immunity and the effects of their immunity in the chaos that the disease created in the heavily populated Aztec capital to mount a new attack. And they assaulted the city with this enormous army, and there was a terrible, terrible battle. And this is all described in the Spanish sources. It was an awful battle. Thousands and thousands of people died. No, they didn't give up.
Yeah, no, this is really interesting because this is one of the tenets of this book, that a lot of the history we learn about European conquest is just utterly wrong, because there's no mention of that huge army Cortez led. It's a small group of Spanish explorers that fit on a number of ships to come over and conquered this huge empire. The same about the Incan conquest,
right,
with Pizarro. Our stories are just utterly wrong, aren't they?
Yeah, it's, what's strange about it is if you read the original Spanish accounts, which are all in print and most of them translated into English, it's clear as a bell what's going on. It's just that over the decades, as you know, these stories get simplified for our history textbooks and so forth, and little details get dropped out, that the whole thing has been sanded down. And it's unfortunate because what really happened is actually much more interesting.
Yeah, and of course, it's sort of a very Eurocentric view, but getting over to Pizarro, I mean, the whole idea it was that Pizarro had what was then modern European weapons, and the Incas lacked the technology to fight them off. The Incas had that technology.
Yeah, they didn't have guns and so forth. They had other kind of technology. I mean, one of the most fascinating parts of this to me is that what happened in the Americas was a completely independent development of human possibilities. And they developed completely different kinds of technologies than were developed in Europe. And so, if your whole idea of what technology is metal gears and that sort of stuff, then, of course, you look at the Americas and you say, well, there wasn't much there. But they had other kinds of technology. They developed other kinds of science. And so, again, if you read the Spanish Chronicles, they had these slings that they're fantastically good at. And once they figured out, first, they'd never seen horses before, and so they had to completely rethink their tactics. Because the horses could move so fast that the Spanish could charge on their horses, and the sentries, who were posted around to warn of attacks, would be beaten by the horses. Once the Inca learned to adjust for this kind of thing, they started doing quite well. And it took the Spaniards 40 years to actually conquer the Inca Empire. And again, very critical to their success was both the fact that many, many groups who had been conquered by the Inca hated the Inca and helped them. And so they marched, with lots and lots of native soldiers. The big battle for Cusco, the capital, was, I think the Spaniards had 40 or 50,000 native soldiers, now estimated, something like that. And the second thing was the same, this was put together by a guy named Henry Dobbins, the same epidemic that had wiped out a big chunk of the Aztecs, moved down through Central America, crossed into the Andes, and wreaked havoc in the Inca. And so he was walking into an empire that had just been flattened by smallpox. And there's a great historian who was very influential in sort of putting together this picture named Al Crosby. He wrote a wonderful book called The Columbian Exchange. And in it, he points out that if Genghis Khan had come to Europe right after the Black Death, you and I would not be speaking an Indo-European language. We would have conquered Europe. And that's sort of what happened in the Americas.
And that also influences the traditional view of the settlement of North America. Now, we have to remember, Columbus comes in 1492. There's exploration through the 16th century. And the first permanent colonies don't come to North America until the 17th century. Yet all those explorers in the 16th century were bringing over diseases that really decimated indigenous populations.
Right. And in fact, it's quite striking. There was a number of attempts to settle, due to create European colonies in North America, missions and actual full-fledged colonization attempts, mostly in the southeast. And the first one was in 1525 or 1526. And Native people beat them all back. And it's only first with Jamestown in 1607, and then, much more consequentially, with the Pilgrims in 1620, that Europeans are finally able to do it. And it's in the early 17th century, right before the Pilgrims, that these epidemics begin. And so, absent the epidemics, it's really hard to imagine how Europeans would have been able to, get a foothold here. And if you think about it, that's quite sensible. They're in these little boats, right? So there's not many of them, and there's an incredibly long and weak supply chain. Once the Europeans were here, they're basically by themselves, and there are millions and millions of native people there. And so the only, it's clear that no matter what kind of superior technology, a single guy, with a 17th century gun is not going to be able to hold off 10,000 people.
No.
And, it was just sort of more or less the situation they would have been in. And it took something else to put its thumb on the scale, and that something else was disease.
And that disease decimated the Northeast just in the years prior to Pilgrim's landing at Cape Cod. Yeah, and so that view that European colonists and explorers found either an Edenic sort of wilderness or that Native people weren't around or had completely primitive cultures is just absolutely wrong as well.
Yeah, And again, that's in the accounts of the original Europeans. The first European to write about what New England looked like that we know of was Verrazano in the 1520s. And he describes going to Buzzard's Bay, which is, you know, where Providence, where Rhode Island, right, that big bay there. And it's where, you know, I think Providence is. And, you know,
Narragansett Bay, yeah.
Narragansett. And there's a description that he does that they land there and that they go for, I can't remember how many leagues, you know, a league is 3 miles, basically. And so they go for many, many, many leagues, and it's all cornfields. There's not a tree to be seen. It's just completely clear. They're sort of marveling at how much food is being grown and how settled the landscape is. And this is true all along the coast, miles and miles of cleared land with villages and cornfields.
This comes
to like France.
Yeah. And this also brings into play another one of the major things that the Europeans found, was you found this incredible agrarian economy and enormous sophistication about plant husbandry and growing monocultures, getting a crop to a point where it can be a monoculture. This all happened in the indigenous population.
Right. And, you know, remember we were talking a little bit earlier about how different places develop different kinds of technology. And in fact, this is one of the wonderful things about trade is, you know, people over here think up something and people over here think up something, and with huge trade, they can both benefit from each other's insights. And over here, there have been this really remarkable development of plant breeding. It's really quite extraordinary. An enormous number of different crops and also agricultural methods have been developed over here. And with a huge boon to the rest of the world. You know, corn, which is, you know, developed in southern Mexico, is now, I think, the second or third largest crop in the world. Potatoes developed in the Andes are the fourth, I believe. And corn, you know, became the staple food of much of Africa, huge chunks of southern Europe. And potatoes, you know, extend in a huge band from Ireland all the way over to Ukraine. And so one of the big consequences of European discovery was the feeding of the rest of the world.
My guest today is Charles C. Mann, the author of 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, and his most recent book, 1493, Uncovering the World Columbus Created. He's a correspondent for The Atlantic, and he'll be opening the University of Tulsa's Presidential Lecture Series Wednesday evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center on the TU campus. Well, that second book refers to what we've just been talking about, this whole exchange of technology from the New World. You have this agrarian technology called the Columbian Exchange. And this, you know, we think of globalization and invasive species as being a 21st century problem. But this was around in the 16th century, too, as well. These same questions.
One of the, I mentioned this wonderful historian, Alfred Crosby, who's at the University of Texas until his retirement. And he was the first guy pointed out and coined the term Columbian Exchange. And what that meant was, if you think about it, you know, for forever, zillions and zillions of years, Europe and Asia and Africa and the Americas have been completely separate. And there had been, you know, next to no communication between them. And there have been the ecosystems in those different places had also been completely separate and had developed in this completely separate way. And when Columbus comes, like he brings all of these different separate systems together, bang, and there's this kind of ecological explosion. There's been nothing like it in the history of life for a really long time. And creatures from over there come over here, huge numbers of creatures from over here go over there, and this plays an enormous role in human history as well.
You tell a story of La Isabella,
yes,
which is a small... it was actually a Columbus's colony in Hispaniola. Would it be on the Dominican side?
Yes, just on the Dominican side. Hispaniola is the big island in the Caribbean that has the Dominican Republic on one part of it and Haiti on the other part of it.
Right.
Pretty close to the border between them, on the northern side, is La Isabella, which was the first attempt at a permanent colony by Europeans in the Americas.
And what happened at La Isabella and also at Santo Domingo, too?
What happened was, so the basic story is that Columbus goes across and is a kind of a flyer by the Spanish monarchs because they've consulted their wise men, and the wise men tell them correctly that what Columbus wants to do is impossible. what Columbus wants to do is to sail across the Atlantic and go to China. And the reason that they say it's impossible is that since the time of Eratosthenes, this Greek mathematician, people have known how big the world is. They know it's roughly 25,000 miles around, and they know how big, you know, the Eurasian landmass is. And so they know that a Spanish ship to reach China would have to sail across what we now know to be the combined Atlantic and the Pacific, as well as all the Americas in between. It's just an enormous distance. And they say 16th century ships can't go that far. They're completely correct. What Columbus wanted to do was impossible. Columbus had talked himself into this by this crazy thing where he thought he had measured the size of the Earth, the size of a degree, and then multiplied by 360, and you get the size of the Earth. And he had convinced himself that the Earth is actually quite a bit smaller than it really is, and then had an incorrect idea about how big the Eurasian landmass is. So he thought it was just, you know, 3,000 miles instead of 12 or something. I don't remember what the exact numbers are. But the point is, he thought what he was doing was possible, and it's not. But totally luckily for him, there is this continent, this hemisphere there, the Americas. So he lands on the very edge of it, brings back some of it, and everybody in Spain is astounded, right? You know, like, holy cow, he brings back Indians, he brings back a little bit of gold, he brings back, you know, strange creatures. And so they send on a second expedition in 1493, one that really gives its name to my book, an enormous expedition that's much, much bigger, you know, with almost 20 vessels, 1,500 people on it, and they're going to set up a real trading depot there because they're convinced, aha, we're on the edge of Asia. And they bring in cows, they bring in horses, they bring in crops to plant, they're going to really do it up. And the mission is a calamitous failure. It turns out Columbus is actually a really extraordinarily good sailor, but he was a terrible administrator. You know, when I was a kid, there was a book called The Peter Principle, where it said that everybody was promoted to the position that they got incompetent at, and
right.
They sat there.
Yeah.
Well, he went from guy running a ship to guy running a colony, and that was his position of incompetence. So he was just awful at it. And so, you know, he ends up actually being sent back to Spain in chains at one point. Everybody hates him. But these other passengers inaugurate an ecological revolution in the Caribbean and then in the rest of the Americas. And today, if you go to, you know, Hispaniola, something like 2/3 of the species, the plant species that are on there, are of non-local origin. It's a totally transformed society, and there's this crazy stuff that happens. Most notably, in Santo Domingo a few years later, they bring in the great biologist Edward O. Wilson, unraveled what probably happened. They bring in banana trees, and they also bring in some of the scale insects that eat, you know, the roots of banana trees, and they go completely crazy. There's nothing like this in the Caribbean, and it turns out that there's fire ants, and the fire ants like the sugary excrement of these scale insects. So the explosion of scale insects leads to an explosion of fire ants, and basically the ants get to be so bad that people are completely driven out of the new colony of Santo Domingo and have to flee the island.
Wow.
And it's a plague of ants, and this is the kind of thing I use as an example of what you talk about, the Columbian Exchange, where this crazy stuff happens because one species is brought over, and then there's all these repercussions that nobody expects.
And the repercussions are worldwide. I mean, it gets a sense that globalization, we think of it as a, you know, something that's happened in our lifetime. There was a similar globalization during this Columbian Exchange. Sweet potatoes grown here in the New World go to China. All of a sudden, China's imperial dynasties are failing, and in some measure to the introduction of these new food crops.
Yeah, it's a wild story, and it's, you know, it's, again, it's something that's just been learned in the last little while. When I was a kid, I went to a really terrible school, and so we never learned anything, right? So I never really looked at a map. You know, it wasn't until I was an adult that I actually started looking at maps. And if you look at a map of China, what you find out is there's no big bodies of water on there. You know, we have the Great Lakes. They don't have anything like that. There's basically no water in China. There's these two big rivers, which are the Yangtze and the Yellow River. And that's it. And so about half the country is just desert with these sharp, dry hills in it. And you can't. And then on top of that, so they have 20% of the world's population, something like 7% of the world's above ground fresh water, and the crop that everybody wants to eat has to be grown in swimming pools. So, right? Rice, right?
Right.
And so it's completely nuts from my point of view. And in a way, that's a good one-sentence summary of a lot of Chinese history. How do we feed everybody growing rice in a country with no water? Well, then, in about 1600, so not that long after Columbus, the sweet potato and then corn, maize, as it's called outside the U.S., come. And it's the first really substantial dry land crop that people have seen in China. And suddenly, all this western area that's been left to indigenous groups becomes cultivable. That's how you say it. You can cultivate it. And you know, the government realizes, hey, this is great. And just as we had a sort of a program of Go West, Young Man, right, that led to the, you know, the movement of people into places like Oklahoma, a parallel thing is happening in China, where they pick up people from the East, the Han, as they're called, and send them over there and tell them to places like, you know, Sichuan, and tell them to start growing corn and sweet potatoes, and later potatoes. And this leads to all this area being logged, planted, and these sharp hills, which, you know, have never really been cultivated like this. People make all these beginner's mistakes, and leads to enormous floods. And so at first, everybody benefits from this incredible increase in agricultural production. But the floods start happening in the 19th century. And if you look at you know, lists of flood disasters, an incredibly large number of them occurred in China in the 19th and early 20th century. And it was due to the erosion caused by the deforestation for planting American crops. And this led to enormous catastrophes for the Qing Dynasty, which was the dynasty that was ruling China at the time, and fed into the, you know, social instability and problems. You had millions of refugees around. Some of the refugees, flood refugees, united and formed this, led this thing called the Taiping Rebellion, in which 20 million people got killed. It was just awful. And this fed into the creation of communist China.
Wow. It's an amazing book, and this Columbian Exchange has had so many far-reaching effects on Europe, Africa, Asia, as well as the Americas. It's documented in the book 1493, Uncovering the World Columbus Created, and his previous book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. My guest is Charles C. Mann, who will be the University of Tulsa Presidential Lecturer Wednesday evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center on the TU campus. I hope a lot of people come out to the Reynolds Center to hear you speak. Charles Mann, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure.
Charles Mann is a writer, a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, and the author of 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, and 1493, Uncovering the World Columbus Created. He'll be opening the University of Tulsa's Presidential Lecture Series in a free lecture at the Reynolds Center tomorrow evening, that's Wednesday evening at 7:30 on the University of Tulsa campus. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look on the page, look for Studio Tulsa, and you can see our most recent shows or search through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.